There was something missing in my life, and I knew it. And I talked to my mom and dad about it, and they couldn't help me. And the older I got, the more acute the sense became. Until by the time I was a young man, I was going around asking people, how do you fill the emptiness in your life? How do you fill the void? And people had no answer for me. I was in the summer after my first year of school, and I was talking to a guy who was a contractor by trade. And I asked him the question. And he said, I think I got the answer for you. And he told me about Jesus Christ. And the moment he said Jesus Christ, I knew I'd found the answer. That was interesting because I knew the name. I used it in vain. But when he said that to me, I bingled right on the spot. And my conversion was total. It was absolute. It was radical. I went home. I told my folks that they too could become Christians, which was the worst possible thing that I could have said to them. It created a rift in my family that was never healed. They always thought I was kind of a meathead, and that confirmed it as far as they were concerned. Moving a little bit ahead, the only redeeming thing I ever did as far as they were concerned was marry Leah. And they could not understand how she could be interested in me. That was beyond their ability to comprehend. But I remember my dad said to me, son, he says, if you don't marry this woman, he says, I don't want to see you again. Don't come around. So, and he wasn't given to jest. When I became a Christian, I knew at that moment that I wanted to serve God. I knew I'd be doing what I'm doing right now. I didn't know how to go about it. I was an engineering major. And so everybody told me if I really wanted to serve Jesus, I got to go to seminary. Well, I didn't know. Baptist from a Roman Catholic. We never went to church. We never read the Bible. We never prayed. We never talked about those things. It was just not a part of our lives. So I changed my major from engineering to philosophy. And the reason I did that was I got into the Bible. And I'd never seen a book quite like that. It was 1,500 pages of small print and no pictures. And it was a thoroughly intimidating book for me. And so as I thought about it, I thought I'm going to have to learn how to think conceptually rather than analytically. So I shifted it over to philosophy for that purpose. As I was moving my way through my schooling, I met the navigators between my 6th and 7th year of school. Billy Graham was having an evangelistic meeting in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so on my way to my summer charge, I went home, lived with my parents, and got involved in the crusade. Now the year before, I had been on the south side of Chicago, and I had been involved in evangelism, and I led a number of people to Christ, but for some reason the church didn't really accept them like I had hoped they would, and I was frustrated. So follow-up, crusade, I thought to myself, that's what I need to do, is learn how to do follow-up. And I met the navigators there, and they said, well, when you go down to your charge in Southern California, there's a Skip Gray who lives in Pasadena, look him up. He might be able to help you. So I called Skip, went over to the home, met him and the family. I told him what I was doing. I said, what I'm wondering is, would you come down to the church and would you teach the men follow-up? He said, I'd be happy to. So once a week for 10 weeks, about 3 in the afternoon, he'd show up. And I'd spend from 3 in the afternoon until about 7:30 at night with him. And then from 7:30 until about 8:30, we had the meeting. Now, I'm not real quick in the uptake, but it wasn't until the second or third meeting, and it began to occur to me that, you know, he was coming down for me. The meeting was ancillary. And I really appreciated that. I had not seen that before. And so he talked to me about follow-up and about building the lives of men. And it occurred to me that my school taught me how to feed myself. My school told me about the importance of feeding the people. But the school never discussed the importance of teaching people to feed themselves. And Skip Gray did that. So he suggested that when I finish school, why don't I move into his home for a little character training. I wasn't that old in Christ, and I knew I wasn't ready to take a pastorate. So I accepted his invitation. I went down and I lived in his home. I taught school at a Christian school about 40-45 minutes from the house. I told them that I was going to be there for just a couple of years, that it was not a priority, and that if there were opportunities for me to do some training, that I would have to call in and have to get a substitute. For some reason, they accepted that. And I made the huge sum, by the way, of $3,000 a year. And so what that meant was that as I lived in the Skip Gray home, there were 8 single guys, 2 single girls, a married couple, Skip, Buzzy, and their kids. We all lived together. And what an environment that was. I had never seen anything like it. And we would sit around the table at night, and we'd spend an hour and a half, 2 hours, massaging the great truths of Scripture. And I found my soul fed. And I grew. And the navigators couldn't get rid of me. So one summer they asked me to go to a place called North Platte, Nebraska. Now, if you know where North Platte is, then you may even know where Maxwell is. And Maxwell is between the 2nd and Burma Shave side on the left-hand side of the road. And if you blink, you pass through Maxwell and I don't even know you're there. And outside of there was a little camp. It was on an island in the middle of the Platte River. And it was called Maranatha. And they had a training program there. And my wife, whom I did not know, and I were involved in that program. I want to go back and make one observation about seminary. In my first year in seminary, God brought me to a crisis in that He knew I really wanted to get married. And the verse He used was Romans 14, whatever is not of faith is sin. And let me know that my shopping for a wife was not walking by faith. For me, not for anybody else, but for me, it meant that I had to stop dating. And I'll never forget that night when I got on my knees and I gave that back to God. It was as traumatic as my conversion. And the Holy Spirit said to me, I want you to take Isaac to Mount Moriah and no rubber knives. And I'm the God of the resurrection, and if I want to resurrect it in my timing, that is up to me, but I don't want you to bring it up again. And so I did. I had no option. I had to do it. I'll be honest with you, I visited the gravesite periodically, hoping that maybe there'd be a movement in there someplace. But nary a sign of life. The navigators did something they normally don't do. They asked Leah and I to go back and work together the second summer. It was in that summer but I found myself falling in love with her. I didn't know what to do with it. Terrified me, particularly because of my experience on Mount Moriah. So I asked God for three things. I said, God, if this is of you, then number one, I pray that when I leave and I go back to work, that if it's not of you, I'd forget about her, out of sight, out of mind. And number two, that it's of you, I pray that you give me a promise. And because I couldn't trust myself with the first two, I said, if they come together, then I'm going to ask for one other thing, and that is I'm going to go to the council of three men who know us both. I'm not going to tell them I'm in love with her. I'm just going to say I'm interested in them. And if any one of them says anything other than marry the girl, then I would know it's not of you. And so, to make a story short, the last one I talked to was Lawrence Sanney, and he said to me, he said, well, if I were you, I would maybe get to know her a little bit, write her a letter, see what happens. And I thought, well, that's it, that ends it. So I got up and left the room, and as I was walking out the door, he says, Henriksen, he says, no. He says, the more I think about it, I'd call her up and ask her to marry me if I were you. So that night I did. And she was working with girls in San Francisco, and I called her on the telephone and asked her to marry me. We never had a date. I never communicated any interest in her. And so I told her, I know it's a surprise to you. I'll give you as much time as you need to recover. But if you think it's of God, I'd like you to be my wife. And so after a period of time, she let me know that she would be willing. And not the smartest decision she's ever made in her life, but but the night that she said yes and we announced our engagement, I in Colorado Springs and she in San Francisco, again, we had not been together, they asked me if I would go down to Jungle Camp. Now, Jungle Camp was pioneer missionary training for the Wycliffe Bible Translators, not too far from where we were today, from the Yucatan Peninsula. And it was an 8-day walk to the nearest town. We got in there by Missionary Aviation Fellowship, flying us in. I spent from November through April in that environment. I tried to talk to navigators and let me marry her and bring her down with me, but they didn't take too kindly to that idea, so I went down without her. So we communicated with each other by letter, and I got back. We courted for, a couple weeks, and then I went to meet her folks. And went to Glen Eyrie for a staff conference, after which she and I got married. So our first date was a double date with another couple. And so we didn't really know each other in terms of that kind of relationship until after we were married. I worked at the Glen that summer. And they asked her if she would go up to Eagle Lake and work with girls up there. So they separated us in the summer of our marriage. And she went up there and I stayed down and worked. And so that's the way the navigators did that. And it never occurred to me that that wasn't something they ought to do. So, after she came back, toward the end of the summer, we had invited Lorne and his wife and the kids over for dinner. We were having dinner together at the home, and this is what Lorne said to me. This is gospel truth. He said to me, Henriksen, he said, I've been thinking about it. He says, I got two choices. I can either lose a really great staff member or gain a rather mediocre one. And to be honest with you, I can't afford to lose Liette, so I was wondering if you'd like to join the staff. And I said, you got yourself a deal. So he said, if that's the case, then you gotta go out there and do the ministry. And so he said, where do you want to go? And I said, where the navigators have never been. And so I picked a part of the country, Michigan. Navigator work was not open there. And we went up there. We had two foot lockers and a steamer truck. And that was the sum total of our possessions. We moved to Kalamazoo, and we rented the downstairs of a home. Now, it had no bedrooms. It had a living room, dining room, and a kitchen. And the dining room windows were papered so that you couldn't see through them. And that became our bedroom. There were no closets. The place was filthy. We cleaned it. The floors were sagging. And no curtains on the windows. No furniture. I had the finished idea what we were going to do. And a guy came by out of nowhere and gave me $50. Which was a princely sum, especially for a guy in my state, because I had no money at all. I was a jungle camp all year. So I telephoned, and they brought a bed out, and we had some place to sleep that night. And Jack Mayhall was my supervisor. He lived in Chicago. We went to visit him, and he had an old couch. We took that back with us, and it was one of those hide a beds, you know, you open it up and it becomes a bed, and we put that in the living room. The guy gave me a door, and I put four legs on it, and that became a table, coffee table. And we had our first guests in the home, and we sat on foot lockers and ate off the steamer trunk. And that's how we started. And because we married late, we started our family immediately, and God gave us four beautiful children. But as we were just getting started, we started having people live with us. And we had a couple guys, a couple girls, Liette and I and the baby, in that no-bedroom house with one bathroom. And some of the businessmen with whom I were working thought that was probably a... not too swift of an arrangement. And so they got together and they bought the Navigators a home, which we moved into, a beautiful home. And we spent four glorious years in Michigan. And two of our four children were born during those years. After which, the Navigators asked me if I would go down to the Southwest and carve out a region. They're going into a regional setup, something they had not had at that point. And so we had four states, Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas. And we had a guy in Stillwater and a guy at Texas A&M. And then we lived in Fort Worth, and that was the sum total of our region. I felt God had called me to work with the Navigators, and different from a lot of men, I felt that I didn't really care where I served. Let them decide for me wherever they wanted me. So they said, go down there. We went down there, and we spent five wonderful years there, and that's when Jim and I began to co-labor together a little bit and develop the friendship we've got. During that time, God gave us two more children, our two Texans. During that time, God gave my oldest son leukemia. And I'll never forget, we were finishing up some ministry, and I met my wife in the hospital where he was going, taken for some tests. And she met me at the door and said, "Our son, it has leukemia." And I knew we'd lost him. And well, didn't think this would happen. I guess it's old age. But I cried my heart out. I cried until there was no more. During those days, Sandy asked me if I'd come back and work with him at Glen Eyrie. So we moved back to Colorado Springs. Because the situation with our son, Rod Sargent found a home for us, bought it, Navigator Home, and we moved into it. And while we were there, Lauren said, "You know, you're getting to the stage in your life where you need to own your own home. Why don't you buy it from the Navs?" And so I said, "I don't know how to do that." So we got a couple businessmen who got some other guys together. They bought the down payment on that. And that's how we got started in our home. It was a lovely home. Beautiful home. Nicer than anything we'd ever seen. And it was there that my son died. And I was telling somebody at the table tonight that nothing in my life, nothing, approximates the pain or the sense of loss. Those were good days working with Lauren. I traveled with him all over the world. I had worked as a short-term missionary in Japan for the summer when I was living in Michigan. So I'd gotten to see that part of the world. Went into evangelism and coming into Japan and did evangelism, working with students who wanted to learn English. So I didn't know a word of Japanese. And so we'd talk English, and they would learn it through the Bible. And there were a bunch of us that did that summer, and it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I wore a number of hats when I was at Glen Eyrie with Lauren. And through those years, he wanted to start working with business and professional men. And so he asked me what I thought we ought to do to get it started. And I said, "Well, it seems to me that we ought to get the guys across the country that are businessmen that love us, invite them out as our guests, and ask them to tell us what to do." So he did that. About 50 of them showed up, met in the great hall around a big table. And Lauren told them what he wanted. And they said that they wanted somebody from the Navigators to help them where they were. That because they were settled in their businesses and their families, they didn't want to move to another city for training. They wanted the Navigators to come and help them where they were. They didn't want directors. What they wanted were, men who would settle up next to them and help them. Kind of coordinate the layman's ministry. The lot fell to me. So I became the coordinator for the layman's ministry. And for a number of reasons, it was not the proper time in the Navigators. So the whole mission was aborted. And at that same time, Lauren felt it would be good for me to have some overseas experience. So Liette and I and the children moved over to New Zealand to work with a delightful man by the name of Joe Simmons. Joe is responsible for PAN, Pacific Area Navigators. He had everything from Japan down through Australasia and India, 11 countries. And I really fell in love with this guy. I think the thing I loved about him, there were many things I loved about him, but I think the thing I loved about him the most was he was nothing but an old carpenter to whom God had been incredibly good, and he never forgot that. Never, no pretension about him. He was just a man of God, and what a delight it was working with him. God knit our hearts together. As a matter of fact, he and his family lived in the home we lived in when we were over there. We still stay in touch with him. After 2 years, the businessmen with whom I had worked were unhappy with the fact that we had aborted the mission. And so they said, you know, why don't you leave the NAVs and do this? Come help us. And so I asked Lauren. I said, Lauren, I'm not asking for your permission. I know you give that to me. What I want is your blessing. If this is what you really think I should do, then I'll go do that. Otherwise, I have no desire to do it. And he encouraged me to do that. So I left New Zealand. We moved back to the United States, back to the house that we had that the Navigators originally helped us buy, and began working with the business of professional men. I've been doing that ever since. And pretty grateful to God for that. They've been good years. So we left the Navigators in 1977, having been with them for almost 20 years. And I look back over my life. I want to say to you that the only regret I have is my own sin and depravity. But truly, my lines have fallen in pleasant places. God has been incredibly good to us. Those of you who know her know I married way, way above myself. And God's never let me forget that. Not only that, but God gave me children who make me look good. And I'm very grateful for that. I could talk about more, but I think I'll stop there and see if you have any questions or comments. Somebody asked me at the table tonight how I wanted to end. What I wanted to do is I finished the race. I told them that the thing I want more than anything else is to finish the race of life without being a major embarrassment to Jesus Christ. If I can pull that off, I will be one fortunate man. Cecil, what do you think?
I got a question. I'm debating whether to ask you or not. You told me earlier that you thought that the age bracket 18 to 25, military and collegiate, was possibly the most fertile.
Yes.
Area.
Yes.
That you knew of. Why do you think God led you out of that fertile area into an area where that type of ministry in to the churches outside of the Mecca has eaten a lot of men?
Yes.
And destroyed, for lack of a better word, direction. Have you got any understanding at this point of why God has done that?
Well, first and foremost, when I left the Navigators to do what I'm doing, it wasn't all that clear that that was the case. I had never really had a baptism of ministry with business of professional men. So what I shared with you was kind of my reflection as I look in retrospect. I said it, Cecil, because the patterns are so thoroughly set by time a man marries and gets into his business that many, many times when a businessman comes to Christ, he spends the rest of his life trying to respond biblically to bad decisions. And the chances of him becoming a producer of reproducers is appreciably diminished. You can catch young men and women in those formative years before the patterns are set. Then you've got a far better shot at producing reproducers. I believe that.
Now that you're involved with businessmen, how would you evaluate how you're doing compared to how you could have done? I don't know if you've reached that into the nebulae.
My brother, I'm in touch with, I don't know, I've never felt comfortable counting. It's like counting the number of verses you memorize. It's like numbering the people. I'm afraid I never lived through that. God just killed me on the spot. But I'm going to guess maybe 50, 60 cities across the country where little coveys of men are functioning for Christ. And by that I mean that they're little bands of men who are studying the Bible, memorizing it, reaching out, doing evangelism, seeing men come to Christ, following them up. Each man in my Bible study has his own ministry in these various cities. So I am I'm grateful and I'm impressed with what God is doing in the lives of a lot of these men. Because Cecil, I felt keenly in my heart that I did not want to chart my own course. Just like I didn't trust myself to pick out my own wife. Self-confidence is nothing I've ever had. It's just the opposite. I terrify me more than anything or anybody else in the world. And I figured early in my Christian life that if I could keep my hands off of the steering mechanism, I might have a chance of surviving. Because I knew that if God had not saved my soul, I would have self-destructed. No question in my mind about it. So, one of the reasons why I was glad to get into the businessman's ministry is that, like in so many organizations, the drift is always up. And the further up you go, and again, I hadn't thought carefully on this, I didn't even try to evaluate it, is the more and more you get out of the grass. Now watch Lorne. I lived with him, ministered with him, spent those wonderful, wonderful years with him. I loved the man like my father. And I believe he loved me. As you know, he's with the Lord now. But I watched what being the president of the Navigators did to him. Men would give him a nice title, call him their president, pay homage to him, and then come into his office one at a time and upchuck all over his desk. And then walk out and let him clean it up. And a man who's willing to do that pays a huge price. Huge. Especially a man with his sensitivity. As I travel with him, I'd watch what it would do to him. How that he would to go to the hospital to get his plumbing straightened out. Things that most people did not know. And I told him, I said, Lauren, anybody that would want your job has got to be out of his mind. Now, who in the world would want that? They take either an idiot or a guy with an absolutely unique calling. I might have qualified for idiot, but certainly not the calling. I had no desire for it. Probably would never have gotten it anyway. Didn't want it. Told him that. So I was eager to get back into the grass. So that was my ticket. I think he sensed that. I think in his love for me, I think, because he never said this to me, I think he knew that I'd be happier and better served doing what I'm doing now, vis-a-vis staying with the outfit. Staying with the organization.
Because they would have pushed you up in the average hour?
Either that or they would have pushed me out. You know, you and I have talked about it. Swallowing me is like trying to swallow a garlic milkshake. So, I'm very grateful. Yes.
Well, you have a unique teaching style in that it causes people to think. How did you come up? How was that formed?
I don't know. Oh, Chuck, I remember my dad. We sit at the table, the four of us. And he challenged me on everything. So I came, remember when I was a little kid, I came home and I said, the world is round. And he laughed. He said, what do you mean it's round? It's flat. I go outside and look. I said, no, it's round. How do you know that? I said, well, they told me that. I can't believe everything you hear, son. Took me 3 days to finally convince him. I said, it's like the moon, Dad. You look up the moon. Yeah, people have gone around the world. He pulled out a coin from his pocket. He says, you can go around the coin all day long. It's still flat. And he fell out this boy. So, that was my father. He wanted me to learn how to think. So, statements were made. Opinions were given, and he always probed me and my siblings. Why? Why do you think that's right? So probably it began there. When I was in seminary, my professors taught with the Socratic method. They gave the students free access to them. And I'll be honest with you, Chuck, I learned as much from my seminary classmates as I did from my professors. A little aside on that, I went to class with 30 young men who spent their lives getting ready for the ministry. Over two-thirds of them had graduated from the university with honors. And I met these guys, and I want to tell you, it was another one of those emotional moments. I went to my room and I cried. I said, God, I wasted my life pursuing trivia while these guys gave their lives getting ready for this. I'll never, ever catch them. But God, I covenant with you. I'll do the best I can to serve you. So those guys they were phenomenal men. And some of the brightest men I've ever met in my life were in that class. was a unique class. I don't know. Maybe that Melu.
While you some strong convictions about obedience and a literal interpretation of the Bible, what happened to you in your life that you realized that was a position of faith? You left through the navigators. How did you get some of those convictions?
It's hard to know, Jim, where one influence ends and the other begins. For sure, the navigators marked me for eternity. I will be forever in their debt. I remember in the nav home, by the way, just parenthetically, my job was to clean the toilets in the house. And so on the weekend, I would be on my hands and knees scrubbing those toilet bowls with Ajax and a sponge, thinking about my classmates getting ready for Sunday morning, thinking to myself, is this really, really what God's called me to do? And concluded, yes. Yeah, it is. Buzzy Gray, years later, confided to me that she had more problems with me than any other individual that had ever lived in the home. And I asked her why. And she says, because you wouldn't give him any rest. Not literally, but figuratively, he'd get up in the morning, I'd be sitting on the hall waiting for him. And I just could not get enough of him. And she thought I overdid it a bit. Probably did. But as I would think through these concepts with Skip, my classmates, it was obvious to me that if the Bible is not the Word of God, I lose all hope of heaven. If the commandments are cultural, so are the promises. So, you get into the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, the path to holiness is obedience. It is not doctrine.
I made a note when you said that yesterday. Can you illustrate that? The pathway to heaven is obedience.
No, the pathway to holiness.
Holiness.
The pathway to heaven is Jesus.
Okay. The pathway to holiness is
obedience. He that has my commandments and keeps them, he it is that loves me. If a man says, I love God and hates that, keeps all his commandments, he's a liar. I don't know how much more plainly it could be.
Thank God for the vehicles.
Well, Jim, like I said, The night of my conversion, as I went home, I knew that I'd be doing what I'm doing today. It was as though God called me to the ministry at the same time he called me to himself. Didn't know what it looked like. I knew that's where I was going. My spiritual pappy, about 10 years older than I don't think he'd ever heard the word follow-up, but he sure did it. He spent hours and hours with me. The most significant thing I learned.
They probably don't know what Jungle Camp is.
Well, Jungle Camp is a white spot in the jungle. I lived in a thatch hut. I slept in hammocks, bathed in the river, and the purpose of it was to train Wycliffe missionaries in pioneer living situations. And you cannot be around those people without being impressed with their dedication. They remind me of the old proverb that quiet water runs deep. So, really love those people. So, interestingly, my daughter ended up marrying a child of Wycliffe missionaries. So what goes around comes around. Went down to where he was born, headwaters of the Amazon River. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were a number of wonderful things. I had a pet jaguar. And I thought it was a male, so I named him Ben. And seriously, then I discovered it was a girl, so I named her Ben-Hur. True story. And then I had a parrot, Perky the Parrot, and Ben-Hur. But,
you know how that ended.
Well, I thought I could train Ben-Hur to not do that. But now one day I saw him stalking the bird, and I thought, there's no way I'm going to train that cat. So I gave it to a buddy of mine, and then when I got a little older, he brought it to the Tuxtla Zoo. Tuxtla is the capital of Chiapas, and left it there. I asked my dad about bringing it home. Man, he was furious. I was only joking, but he thought I was serious, and man.
Well, you mentioned earlier that Christianity created a rift in the family that was never healed.
Yes.
Could you expound a little bit more? How did your father or did your family reconcile, or how so? Could you expound a little bit on that?
Well, it wasn't a rift that meant I was persona non grata. It was a rift that meant that my mom and dad perceived it as a rejection of the way they had trained me. I had no idea. Never crossed my mind that people were not Christians because they didn't want to be. I assumed, well, after I got converted, that the reason they weren't Christians is they didn't know about it. And so it was a grenade that went off in my face, and I was totally surprised. I know that my wife and my children gave a credibility to it that I never had before then. I know that the children of my siblings were a bitter disappointment to my mom and dad. Peeled off into the drug culture, and it just goes on and on. My kids would come over and sit on their lap and kiss them and love them and ask their counsel and stuff. Yeah, they were putty in my kids' hands. So.
Did your folks ever come to Christ?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. Prayed every day for them, sometimes several times a day, for 40 years. Begged God. Not that I ever saw. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. Yes, Chuck.
A lot of us have people living in our homes. For Deb and I, it's relatively new. What would be the advice that you would give as far as maybe the top three things as far as having people live in your home?
Number one, got to know them well. Number two, they got to love my kids. I don't want them around if they don't love my kids. And by that, I mean also my wife. My wife's got to be for it. If she's not for it, we're not going to do it. And they got a heart for God. They really want to move with God as best I can tell. Of course, people always surprise you. People living with us, Chuck, was one of the most rich blessings our family ever experienced. My kids all look back with nothing but gratitude and delight. Fondness of memories. Can you imagine having 6, 7, 8 brothers and sisters all older than you who dote on you? I mean, it was a dream world for them. Yes, Jim.
How long did you have these guys living with you?
Oh, it varied from a year, 2 years, probably 2 years at the most, wasn't it, honey? Yeah. Sometimes shorter than that, yeah. Yeah, we had a guy from Hong Kong living with us. And he was a delight, still is, good buddy of mine. He didn't live more than about, 6 months or so? So, varied.
Did you have to have move a man out of your house?
I don't think so, did we, honey? No. I don't remember any trauma in that sense. You know, we had some... You know, some of the people had, you know, things they had to work through, but there was no rift in the relationship and no abandoning Christ or anything like that. Yes?
Well, you were on the business because you traveled a lot, right?
Yes.
Did you take those people that lived with you?
No, I started my travel after that. No, that's not true. When I was regional director, no. We had people living with us, and I traveled. And I get, excuse me, not when we, I was with Lauren. We had people living with us, and I traveled. I gotta modify this. I'm getting old here. Sweetheart? Yeah, we had 4 people living with us when I traveled with Lauren. Yeah, the real heavy travel didn't come until after I moved to New Zealand. And in New Zealand, my kids were getting older. I began to sense my daughter competing with the girls in the home. I thought, that's not going to work. So we just terminated it when we moved to New Zealand.
Well, when you say... You sense that your daughter was competing with the girls in the home. What do you mean by that?
Sweetheart.
What are some of the things that were happening?
you. You know, anything you can do, I can do better. Mentality, you know, kind of like the Annie put in. And I think God just gave us the insight to see it.
You gotta remember.
She wasn't aware of it. She was doing it.
No, I don't. It's like, you can remember, my oldest daughter is a general looking for an army. And she always has been. And I told her husband before they married, I said, son, I'm sure you're going to be able to handle her, but I want to tell you, if you ever stutter, she'll take it. So. Oh, and on my granddaughter, my daughter in spades, Mercy. Yes. Yes, she is. But Cecil, thank you very much.